future to be dangerous?
If it is the business of the future to be dangerous, then what is the business of the past? How are past, present and future connected to each other in an age when so much of what we know of the past comes to us through media of one form or another? Our past is old movies or TV shows from the archive. Hello, my name is Mackenzie Walk. Welcome to Big Ideas. Our big idea for today is media and its relation to time. This is something that has been of interest to me for a long time. All through the 90s, I taught media studies, mostly at Macquarie University. I also had a newspaper column in The Australian. I wrote some books. I made some radio programs. Then in 2000, I moved to New York City, where I'm still teaching and writing about media and occasionally making some. This year marks the 100th birthday of Marshall McLuhan, perhaps the most famous exponent of the question of media. ABC Radio National asked me to return to Sydney and help make some radio programming about him. It's been, as I'll explain, an interesting journey in more ways than one. McLuhan is not just someone who had ideas about the media. He became what he beheld. He became a media phenomena in his own right. From the late 60s on, he seemed to be everywhere, a one-man channel, broadcasting his own weird frequencies. He gave lectures, wrote books, was quoted, discussed, interviewed. He was a rock star. He was a Canadian professor of English in a suit and tie, and also a rock star. He didn't just appear in magazines, he had his own. The Medium is the Massage, published in 1967, distills his oracular statements down to sound bites and gives them the best art direction money could buy. He put an actual record album out in 1968, like any rock star of the time would. The auditory version of The Medium is the Massage even had a rock star producer, John Simon, better known for albums by the band Leonard Cohen and Janis Joplin. The Medium is the Massage is maybe not producer John Simon's best work or even McLuhan's. It sounds a bit like this.
Medium is the Massage. The Medium is the Massage. Marshall McLuhan.
Yeah, how about that?
Still, McLuhan himself was a hit. He toured the world, making his oracular pronouncements. But like most rock stars, he wore out his audiences, which dwindled down to the nub of hardcore fans. Which is why, in 1977, he embarked on an Asia-Pacific tour and played Australia. He was in his late 60s by then and not a well man, but he was still in command of his art. His art, above all else, was the art of speech. It's not coincidental that his mother was an elocution teacher. What he did was take the oratorical arts she taught and make them modern. He didn't recite Shakespeare sonnets or Bible verses, although he could do that too. He didn't exactly recite modern literature, although he knew his Joyce and Pound and Wyndham Lewis intimately. What he did was improvise oratorical performances. Like any good modernist artist, one of his main concerns was to make the form in which he worked reflect on itself. By the 60s, people were used to writing that did this. But what was modern oratory? Modern literature knew itself to be something mass-produced, paperbacks churned out by the millions.
Printing.
Modern oratory was something else. It was electric. It was microphones and amplifiers, microphones and broadcast towers, loudspeakers moving the air, not only in the auditorium, but making people's living rooms into auditoriums and moving the air in there as well. So McLuhan became an auditory modernist. Only his form wasn't music. He wasn't really a rock star. He was an orator. He was perhaps the first oracular modern artist. Whenever an artist becomes sensationally popular, and then that popularity just fades right away, there could be a lot of reasons. Perhaps in some cases, it was all just a misunderstanding. Maybe that's what happened with McLuhan. People thought this oracular modernist was really an oracle. They thought he could predict the future, and not just the future of media. They thought he could predict the effect media itself would have on the future.
Professor McLuhan, is television the ultimate medium, or is there worse to come?
You've heard of the hologram? The hologram goes completely around you. Television only goes a little bit around you. The hologram is 360 degrees. But it's been anticipated by these the rock music in which you have to become just enclosed in a sound bubble. The hologram does for TV what rock does for auditory entertainment. But the hologram is technically here.
Well, he wasn't quite right about those holograms. The hologram was not the next big thing in media. Pity the poor media mogul who invested in holograms on this kind of soothsaying. To be fair, this little exchange is not McLuhan at his best, but even here there's still something to think about. What is he really saying? Rock music is an all-enclosing auditory bubble. What if you could hear in those walls of sound, that surround sound, intimations of something coming for all media? Maybe media really did become holographic, but not in a literal sense. Media isn't a speaker or a screen in a room anymore. It's an environment. You know you're soaking in it. And it creates multidimensional effects. It springs out into your other spaces. Right now it's moving the very air around you, making everything around you vibrate. McLuhan isn't an oracle, he's an orator. He's a modernist orator. His subject is the form of oratory itself. Even his books have the texture of transcribed speech. McLuhan's reflexive take on the oral performance is the ground on which he invokes other figures as well. He populates the ground of a self-aware oratory with enough figures to invoke a whole world. He's not as great a modern writer as James Joyce. He's not even as great a literature scholar as his Cambridge University teacher, I.A. Richards. But he goes somewhere they didn't quite go, into what displaces and reframes the written word, electric media.
Television is cool and radio is hot. That's the message, and the medium is Marshall McLuhan. Good evening, and welcome to Monday Conference, which has often been said to be not so hot. When future historians look back on the 20th century, it's almost certain that one of the statements from this era, which they will treasure for posterity, is the medium is the message. Like most of Marshall McLuhan's statements, it's pithy, apparently simple, and provocative to the point of being outrageous. Another of his propositions is that some media are cool and some are hot. Marshall McLuhan studies the media as a way of understanding what it is that makes us live in the way we do, as a way of understanding society itself. He's concerned with all media, but he's best known for his work on the electronic media, particularly radio and television. He sees them as the extension of our central nervous system and argues that they're leading to an electrical re-tribalization of the West. If there is a Mr. Electric of the 20th century, it's Marshall McLuhan.
This was the Sydney stop on McLuhan's 1977 tour of the Asia Pacific. He was invited to address an audience of advertisers, and after that he appeared on the Monday Conference TV show with the legendary ABC broadcaster Robert Moore. I remember watching it at the time. I was 16 years old. Who knows, perhaps it was watching Marshall McLuhan on television that made me want to become, eventually, through various twists and turns, a professor of media studies. I even became a media historian of sorts, although I'm interested in the history of a media movement quite different to the one that constellates around McLuhan's name. But I find myself in the uncanny position of being, for this moment at least, one of those future historians looking back on McLuhan and his famous aphorism, "The media is the message." There's a famous story to the effect that McLuhan was going to call his 1967 book "The Medium is the Message," but the proof of the cover came back with a typo reading "The Medium is the Massage." McLuhan loved it and kept it. Like Joyce, McLuhan loved puns. He did not use language as a way of making a judgment on what was before his eyes. Rather, he used words as probes, like radar. He would send out a frequency, listen for it to bounce back off the objects in its path, and try to sense the contours of the landscape they revealed in the pattern of the foldback.
The moralist, by the way, is always a person who never studies effects so much as studies the content of situations. He studies the figure and not the ground. This, I think, is of great concern to advertisers who are here tonight in some numbers. Advertisers tend to study figure, not the ground. They tend to count noses rather than to estimate the pressures under the noses. The form of gnosis.
His gnosis, his knowledge, was a way of following his nose. He could smell whatever it was we'd stepped in. One thing I remember from hearing McLuhan when I was a teenager was his image of the rear-view mirror. If it is the business of the future to be dangerous, it's the business of the past to be uncanny. It's strange listening now to the tape of McLuhan in Sydney in 1977 and comparing it to what I thought I remembered.
I made a strange discovery about the rearview mirror, having accused a lot of people of living in the rearview mirror and having meant by that that they were out of date, that they were 19th century miles. I then took another look into the rearview mirror on my own. I was not criticized. I did this on my own. And I discovered, somewhat to my surprise, that when you look in the rearview mirror, you do not see what has gone past. You see what is coming. And the rearview mirror is the foreseeable future. It is not the past at all. The title, the phrase rearview mirror, appears to distort the situation. Most people think of it instinctively from the sound of the phrase, it must be the past.
Picture Marshall McLuhan driving down a vast and endless gun barrel highway across the open plains of his native Canada. He looks in the rearview mirror at the highway receding behind him into the distance. For that second of looking back, his car still goes forward. He doesn't swerve or lose control. For that second looking back, he sees what's happening as it happens. He sees the foreseeable future. Now, imagine you're driving down some narrow and twisty track, swerving this way and that, dodging rocks and cliffs, and you're looking in the rearview mirror, but you can't take your eyes off the mirror. It's all you can see. That's all of us. That's McLuhan's image of modernity. McLuhan's angel of history is driving some big American car but can't see where it's going and can't stop until the fuel runs out. And there's nothing this angel of history can do. There's no oracles, no seers, no way to peer ahead. The best you can do is smell the vinyl of the car's interior, listen for crunching sounds under the drum of the fast-spinning wheels, and hope you don't plow over a cliff into the river of time itself.
Water, but we're pretty sure it wasn't the fish.
I believe it. I really believe it.
McLuhan was a fish out of water. His art was making strange the environment we take for granted, the media we don't think about any more than the air we breathe. When it comes to media, people usually want to talk about content. This is a good TV show. That is a bad one. I like this pop song, but I don't like that one. This video game is bad for kids, this educational program is good for kids, and so on. McLuhan usually deflected questions about content back toward questions of form. He wasn't interested in form and content, he was interested in form and form.
Pardon me, butting in. So the question of radio and television programs, if the medium, if radio is the message or television is the message, is there any standard by which you can judge that one television program or one radio program is better than another? What is left for critical standards?
The content is another medium, by the way. In any case, whatever. Well, for example, when you're talking the telephone, you're using your own acoustic and oral medium on another instrument. The content of any medium is another medium. You see, it doesn't much matter what you say on the telephone. The telephone as a service is a huge environment, and that is the medium. And the environment affects everybody. What you say on the telephone affects very few. And the same with radio or any other medium. It's very tricky, and I don't think very meaningful. It's
What's not meaningful? You can't say that one television program is better than another.
No, it's like asking people whether they're enjoying their latest cold.
The way he handles those questions is an art. McLuhan was an artist more than a scholar. These days it's common for universities to have artists of all kinds on the faculty, teaching filmmaking or creative writing or visual art. But in the 60s, this was less common. What was even less common then, and is still uncommon now, was the idea of the professor as artist of the media. So, because McLuhan went to university and wrote a thesis, he's read as if he was a scholar. But Samuel Beckett also went to university and also wrote a thesis. Only nobody complains about Beckett that his books lack footnotes. Nobody says that Beckett would be better if he wrote more boring sentences. And interestingly, nobody says of Beckett that he was a media artist. But among other things, Samuel Beckett was one who, like Guy Debord, worked the media in quite the opposite way to McLuhan, through elusiveness, apparent disinterest, distance. It's not as if McLuhan wasn't clear about all of this.
The artist, the anima of society, points out things that many people would prefer not to notice. Art is anything you can get away with.
McLuhan got away with making media art, getting paid for it, and touring the world like a rock star. But he left behind this misunderstanding, that what his stuff is about is media. Media is not the content of McLuhan speak, it's the form. The content of any media form is other forms. How strange it is that people thought the guy who said the medium is the message had a message. What he did was perform the forms of modern electric media. He had electric elocution. That was his act. No serious reader expects Joyce or Beckett to have a message for them, independent of the form of the writing itself. It's the same with McLuhan. McLuhan is a media theorist in an analogous way to Joyce being a literary theorist. That is to say, incidentally, it's an effect of the art, of a modern art, that you perceive the form of the thing itself. It's a special effect. Looking back now from another century, one in which one cannot quite say the times are modern with quite the same confidence, it's instructive to ask, who are McLuhan's inheritors? Well, maybe one of them is Rupert Murdoch. When Hegel saw a conquering Napoleon ride into his city in 1806, he described him as the world spirit on horseback. Maybe Rupert Murdoch was the world spirit on commsat. The person who, for good or ill, really got what the media environment is about, even if what he was interested in was not gnosis but counting noses, or maybe leading people by them. But I don't really want McLuhan remembered that way. He was happy to talk to advertisers and media executives, to do his act for them and cash their checks. But he wasn't of their world, and didn't really give a damn about selling breakfast cereal or making hit shows. He was interested in gnosis, in knowing the media, in knowing this temporal world. His form of knowing wasn't exactly scholarship. His inheritors are not really professors of media studies like myself. His effect on the study of media, one has to say, is somewhat mixed. Scholarship has an impersonal aspect. It's about building knowledge where each scholar builds on the bulwark of her predecessors. It has limited use for charismatic one-offs. No wonder the University of Toronto shut McLuhan's centre down the minute he was too weak to fight for it. His colleagues, his countrymen, betrayed him. That's how it is with oracles. They're artists. They have no country. McLuhan's real inheritors are people whose métier is not the written word or the drawn image or the projected sound, but who work with all of them. We'll meet a couple of people who do interesting work with and in media environments a little bit later. But first, let's turn our ears on and hear the man work.
Literacy as a form of awareness is a highly specialist and objective sort of thing. You can stand back and the literate man can stand back objectively and look at situations. The TV person has no objectivity at all.
But does television, say, promote illiteracy or doesn't it?
It tends to create a totally different kind of awareness, which is rather that of involvement. Literacy is objective. TV is subjective, totally involving.
In what sense could any of this be true? It's true in the same way, say, Beckett's poem Cascando is true. It's true to something a medium can do. Here is a way of answering questions. Here is a way one thing can be compared to another. Here is a way you can form an image of two things through making statements about their difference from one another. Is it really true that literacy is a different form of awareness to TV awareness? Well, yes and no. You feel the difference, even if it's not quite what McLuhan says it is. This statement about the difference between these things isn't true, but it is true that there are these things and that they are different. Imagine you're talking about some movie you just saw and some smarty pants says, "Yes, but it's not as good as the novel." With a little McLuhan under your belt, you have the perfect comeback. But that's a ridiculous statement. It's like saying, "That's a very nice fish, but it isn't as nice as a bicycle." McLuhan insists that media are incommensurable. Chalk and cheese. So media are environments we can't quite sense. So media are different from each other in ways that can't really be articulated. So we're driving over a cliff in our media vehicles, looking into the rearview mirror. How did anybody mistake this guy for the prophet of the brave new world of electric spectacle? In part because he let them. There he was, in the 60s, a middle-aged college professor in a suit and tie, quoting Joyce and Shakespeare, a man of almost infinite jest. It was a put-on, but he was upfront about it.
I put them on. Putting people on means teasing them, challenging them, upsetting them, befuddling them. The technique of putting people on, in my case, consists simply in pointing to the things they have ignored, the things that concern them very nearly, but have been totally pushed aside as insignificant. A put-on is a sort of situation that I study a good deal.
And it's not as if he came offering nothing. Like all of the interesting modern artists, he attacked form with formal methods. He found an Archimedean point in turbulent waters, that incommensurable gap between media. That is exactly the place from which to operate. Work in the gap between media, both in what you say and in how you say it.
One of the peculiarities of electric speed is that it pushes all the unconscious factors up into consciousness.
Like Freud, he was looking for a method, but it's the media unconscious that is his domain. Electric speed pushes the unconscious up into consciousness, and you can sense it, fleetingly, but only if you train hard, only if you limber up. Like most artists, McLuhan makes it look easy, but it's really, really hard work. He could do it because he knew something about the entire history of Western civilization, from the sophists to Mickey Mouse. If you look hard enough, in Plato, you can find the fissure between the orality of Homer and Socrates and the writing which takes those oral forms as the content for a new media, the media of writing.
We shape our tools, then thereafter our tools shape us.
Specific media environments have particular contours, and they shape us after their image. We become what we behold. Strangely enough, for someone rooted in a classical training, there's no such thing for McLuhan as the Western literary tradition. At the very least, there was the oral world of Homer, then the written world of Plato, then the scriptorium of Aquinas, then the printed world of Luther, then the newspaper world of Joyce, then the electric world of McLuhan himself. In each of which there's different species of art and knowledge laid down like archaeological layers.
The hidden aspects of the media are the things that should be taught because they have an irresistible force when invisible. When these factors remain ignored and invisible, they have an absolute power over the user. So, yes, the sooner that the population, or the young or old, can be taught the effects of these forms, the sooner we can have some sort of reasonable ecology among the media themselves. What is desperately needed is a kind of understanding of the media which would permit us to program the whole environment, so that, say, literate values would not be wiped out by new media.
Most good artists are teachers, but not all teachers are artists, nor should they be. The medium is the message. The medium is the massage.
Medium is the massage. The medium is the massage. Marsha McLuhan, Marsha McLuhan.
Like the parrot, we can parrot the phrase. And like the parrot, we don't actually know what it means. But unlike the parrot, perhaps, we can come to an understanding of media, from the performance itself. McLuhan's alpha and omega was the relation of media to the body. Beyond that scale, his art doesn't quite work the same way. His book, The Medium is the Massage, was like a greatest hits album that in 1967 was itself a hit. He followed up with a little book called War and Peace in the Global Village. It didn't quite go over so well. McLuhan was a man out of joint with his times. For a while it worked, then it didn't. Ironically, Global Village might be the closest thing in McLuhan to an actual prophecy. It's the one that most came true.
Ours is a brand new world of all-at-onceness. Time has ceased, space has vanished. We now live in a global village. The simultaneous happening. We're back in acoustic space. We have begun again to structure the primordial feeling, the tribal emotions, from which a few centuries of literacy had divorced us. The tribalizing process, the inner trip, the depth involvement in the experience of a unified human family, that is something of which we have had no experience for many centuries. It is a process that is located so entirely in the present that it does not appear at all in the rearview mirror, to which we habitually look for reassurance and nostalgic orientation. Joyce called it all space in a not shell. A not shell being an eternal present.
McLuhan loved all the founding talents of liberal learning. He loved rhetoric and grammar and dialectic equally, and tried to practice them all together as the way to keep in touch with the world as a whole. In the McLuhan lexicon, Global Village is old news, it's the living dead, it's an open secret, it's vintage modern, it's virtual reality. In other words, it's an oxymoron, a clash of adjective and noun that don't belong together. It's supposed to reveal a paradox, but has become a cliche. Even when I was a teenager, I could sense there was something a bit off about the way McLuhan talked about it. He would go off on riffs about the black man and the white man, about how tribal people live mythically and in depth. He, McLuhan, didn't really see the ground beneath the figure. He didn't get it. He didn't get the politics of race. It's not the least reason he didn't survive the 70s. 1968 was absolutely past the due date when a white man could tell black people what they were supposed to think and feel and be. Still, there's something in this little oxymoron, Global Village. How do media remake relations between boundaries, between insides and outsides, between us and others, between heres and theirs? We're not looking in the rearview mirror anymore, driving our modern motor over a cliff. We're texting. The rearview mirror is a little screen where we thumb text endearments to a loved one, someone in our village, but who could be on the other side of the planet, who thumb texts back while we drive another car over a different cliff. McLuhan's art was one steeped equally in grammar, rhetoric, and dialectic. Grammar, in the sense that he knew how to read. He knew the texture of media, back to the Bronze Age. Rhetoric, in the sense that he knew the art of putting things together. He knew the art of persuasion. Timothy Leary credited McLuhan with coming up with the hippie mantra, turn on, tune in, drop out. He was trying to give Leary a good jingle. But McLuhan was also interested in dialectic. He had an original take on the call and response of voices to each other. Sensing the world through media means a subtle way, not only with inputs and outputs, but also the feedback pattern of call and response as well. Okay, you've heard my thoughts on Marsha McLuhan. Now let's hear from two of my friends, Paul Miller and Doug Rushkoff. They're colleagues and contemporaries. They're on the McLuhan wavelength, but hear him differently. Doug Rushkoff is a writer, speaker, filmmaker, graphic novelist, and broadcaster. We'll catch up with Doug soon. But first, here's Paul Miller, a.k.a. DJ Spooky, that subliminal kid. He is a DJ, artist, author, and filmmaker.
Is there Wi-Fi here? Can the studio let me know? Do I need a password or? Okay.
So, Paul, the first thing I'd like to ask you is there's a few famous slogans of McLuhan's, and I just want to run a few by you and see if in your mind they kind of still work and if there's still kind of things that you can get out of the idea of, for example, global village and retribalization. Is this a kind of useful or meaningful concept in the 21st century?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the idea of retribalization and the idea of the kind of alphabetic man and the notion of the kind of archival mania that seems to be, you know, kind of enveloping our entire culture. Those are things that I think he really elaborated on in a way that was very compelling for a mass audience. So much of what's going on now with everyone updating their entire life to Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and all that kind of stuff, it's incredible because the idea of the self as archive and the notion of the documented self, or the, now it's the cloud self, these are things that McLuhan really was kind of, I think, presaging, you know. So those kind of phrases, the notion of going back to the origins of philosophy, if you look at Socrates and Plato and the idea of memory, he said, don't write things down because you're going to forget them, and it changes memory. You realize that when McLuhan says every medium and every technology influences and readapts and changes the ratios of perception, as he likes to call it, you know, those are things that really are incredibly resonant with our era.
McLuhan thought there were really quite specific properties to, if you like, the print regime and the electric regime of media. And as somebody who's worked, if you like, vividly in both, do you feel there's any relevance to that? Do you feel there is actually a kind of a different environmental space for you as a writer or as someone who works with sound or someone who works with the visual media?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, everything a human being does, because we're part of the continuum of nature, doesn't mean that it's all of a sudden we're outside of the perspective of things. We are the perspective, our perspective of architecture that we kind of engage the planet through. It's eerie because we, you know, your eyes can only see in certain frequencies, your ears can only hear in certain frequencies of this, you know, acoustic spectrum or the visual spectrum. So what ends up happening is we see the universe and experience the universe through very small windows. You know, if you really, you know, just portals into these. If you think about how vast the universe is and all this phenomena that goes on, I mean, we're trying to give structure to something that is way past our basic, I mean, we're biological phenomena, but at the end of the day, I mean, it's still, we're just getting started here. But what I think is incredible about McLuhan is that his work, I think at least, my nickname for him is biological surrealism. Hmm. When you get to this notion of the mechanical bride and this idea of the uncanny, that Sigmund Freud was trying to enunciate in his stuff about the unconscious. McLuhan, I think, really structured his prose and his soundbite style of speech to be able to give a tremendous amount of meaning in a very small space, which, again, it goes back to this idea of the soundbite as a kind of unpackable, you know, zip file, you know.
But he also talked about how we tend to view the future in a rearview mirror, that we're always kind of looking backwards. And we read the what's coming through what's past. Do you think that's still a relevant concept for the problem of how we're sort of hurtling through the 21st century now?
Yeah, I mean, the rear view mirror for us is this idea that we have contemporary kind of, for lack of a better word, like entropy. And the funny part about entropy, of course, is it goes to physics. And I tend to find that some of the issues that McLuhan was dealing with, you like an essay or you like a TV show or you're interested in a blog, great. But what ends up happening is that the underlying structure of how you encounter that information is what I think McLuhan was really trying to figure out. So text and the body, text and the world around us, these are things that I think a lot of people are trying to, you know, children, I mean, they get it. It's eerie because they're sending, instead of writing an essay about the body, they'll send you an image of their body, you know, or some wild stuff like that. I mean, with McLuhan, what I'm finding, you know, with his album, he did a record called The Medium is the Massage. It was a remix of his own book. Now, in the original book, it was meant to be about graphic design, fonts, textuality, provocative images associated with each group of phrases. So he wanted to make a kind of a graphic design manifesto about, again, like linguistics, psychology, response to the mass man, you know, this idea of people sharing collective memories and so on. And that's what records are. If you think about it, if everybody knows a Rolling Stones song and everyone knows the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's, whatever, those are shared experiences. And what I find fascinating about the medium is the massage record is that he was someone already applying this idea of sampling and detournement, pulling apart fragments of every bit and piece of his own book and having, say, for example, if there's an italicized image or an italicized word in the medium's massage, he had a different actor read it. Or if there was a bold font, that would be the voice of someone else. So the book switches between ways of presenting phrases and sentences. Like you'll be reading one page and it'll one half of it will be italics, the other is like slanted words and bold. And what's fun about that is now, of course, we live in a digital era where Microsoft Word or Windows Pages, whatever, you know, all these different softwares that let you treat words, you know, as these kinds of visual objects. Font has become kind of an art form in its own right. So imagine an acoustic font, an acoustic landscape where every aspect of what you're hearing has been edited. You know, and that's, I mean, I'm using that pun because you're thinking about film, you're thinking about editing a visual text, or you're thinking about editing a sound, and that's the blur. So he got that very early on. The record came out in 1968. It's been very hard to find, very rare. I collect records, so I had a copy, and I've been pushing Eric McLuhan, who's Marshall McLuhan's son, to reissue it. And so this year marks the centennial of Marshall McLuhan. He would have been 100 years old. So I thought it was a really good time to get it out. It's, you know, the Jamaicans just took that and applied it to tape collage. But again, while they're doing that, the Beatles were using Abbey Road Studio, or you had Pink Floyd doing an entire collage album, you know. But that was mass culture. Even Hendrix's Electric Ladyland. All of this is in the mid-60s. The idea was that the studio became an instrument, you know, and sampling updates that and pulls it into mass culture for our digital era. So I think McLuhan, again, he really, it's eerie how much he's so on point as a theoretician and practitioner.
If there's one thing about McLuhan that probably doesn't survive, is that he was personally extremely reactionary.
Yeah, he was conservative.
He knew and respected Ezra Pound and Wyndham Lewis in their, you know, sort of least attractive period. And he was not keen on the civil rights movement. But he never spoke publicly about this. We know this from the correspondence and things like that. So how do you explain the paradox of getting one thing and just not getting another in McLuhan?
I think McLuhan was about this idea of discourse. And if something couldn't be processed in a certain way, you know, he had to be able to try and break down into the component elements. But I doubt, I mean, his album was made with jazz fragments, for example. And you can hear all this kind of collage of jazz. I think that's a good sign. But you're right. Conservative, yes. Reactionary, compared to the American model of reactionarianism, very mild. I think he wanted societal order, but at the same time, he was writing about the way the world was going, which was at that time in the 60s seemed really, really wild. And if you look at 1968, when the album came out, you had over 100 cities in America on fire. You had the Vietnam War, just a lot of dramatic metaphors for society and upheaval. So I think he felt like, let's take stock of this, but whoa, you know, just take a deep breath here. This is intense. So McLuhan is one of these people that can be so broad that he can fit into a lot of contexts, but he's so specific when he's in those contexts, it actually is eerily resonant and it works.
Paul Miller, a.k.a. DJ Spooky. He's also an artist, author, and filmmaker. You're listening to Big Ideas on ABC Radio National. I'm Mackenzie Walk, and now for another take on Marshall McLuhan. We turn to Doug Rushkoff. He's a writer, speaker, filmmaker, graphic novelist, and broadcaster.
I mean, I guess I'm a commoner when it comes to McLuhan. I mean, the things that mattered most were the things that spread mimetically the most. You know, the medium is the message is a great way of articulating any similar flip like that. To me, the medium and the message is almost less about media than saying, look at it from the inside out. You know, just turn it around and you say, oh my gosh. And it's not even that the medium is the message. It's just, it's a message, you know, that you might not know is there if you're so focused on the message being the message. It's a style of logic that could be applied so well to cultural institutions, from the stock market to almost anything, to religion, to Jesus, to the Torah, that it's a really valuable analytical tool, almost more than it is a comment on media.
What do you think about the idea of global village and retribalization? Is this still a sort of useful frame?
I'm actually been considering digging back into McLuhan to see what he really thought about what was happening and what was available to him to model his ideas of global village. You know, for me, when I think about McLuhan, I think about the technologies that were emerging in his era. And that was, you know, satellites and global TV and a global medium. And I perceived his global village as sarcastic. You know, he was kind of a hippie hater. You are going to get your global village, aren't you? Well, you know what global village is going to look like? It's going to look like globalism. It's going to look like giant corporations sort of owning the global media landscape. He understood ideas of feedback, but they were looking at feedback in terms of, here's the broadcast entity, the corporation or the government, and here are all the people who are going to feed back to it. I don't think he was looking at all the people feeding back to one another the way the internet does. So I think while he was looking at Global Village as the single giant retribalized globe, I feel like what we got, you know, with the internet and social media is much more regional. You know, when I look at Arab Spring, say, Arab Spring does not look like what I imagined McLuhan to be describing. I feel like Arab Spring is local and social, not global in its intent. And I wonder if social media is just one further step removed from the media, the electronic media environment that McLuhan was trying to describe, that what we're actually in is now a digital media environment, which is not electronic. It's not analog. It's not command and control. It's more fractal and iterative.
In some ways, would that not be more like what McLuhan talked about as attributes of print media, which was all about the way that print could kind of segregate, categorize, organize, linearize, if you like? Or do we have something that's a synthesis of the Gutenberg universe and the electric one?
I think we're in an era of multimedia. So we end up with much less discrete, identifiable categories for the particular media that we're using. You know, a computer terminal is at once hot, cool, cold, and warm, depending on what software you're using, what networking technology you're using, what function you're trying to elicit from that software, and how much you know about it. So, you know, the very same program, the very same keystroke might be a cool literate experience for one person and a hot oral experience for another person. So it all gets it gets kind of convoluted. And when it does, what you start to see then is McLuhan being invoked to support whichever contention someone wants to make about that media experience. I mean, the darkest thing I think to happen to McLuhan was his being invoked by, you know, Kevin Kelly and Louis Rossetto of Wired magazine as the patron saint of their movement. And what their movement was the capitalization of the net, you know, from they were trying to wrest the internet from the Mondo 2000, Are You Serious psychedelic heads and bring it back to Wall Street. By claiming him, they were claiming the sort of knowledgeable authoritative frame on the rapid change that was going to happen. And McLuhan's work wouldn't have been, he wouldn't have been at all harmonious or consonant with the values of a long boom economy and sort of the rampant libertarianism of the wired culture. McLuhan is he's open ended enough that he can be abused in this way. Where really, I feel like what he's trying to do is he's supposing, you know. So well, let's suppose it's this, or let's suppose it's that, or let's look at it this way, let's look at it that way. Because we're so disoriented, you know, because we're so threatened by the rapid pace of change and by our migration into a digital space, I think we're turning to McLuhan for guidance in navigating a path through this new territory, where McLuhan wasn't trying to provide guidance. What McLuhan was trying to do, more like a Timothy Leary, was force people out of their complacency into questioning things, into challenging their assumptions about the media environments in which they're spending their time. And so I don't think people are going to find the sort of the bedrock that they're looking for in there.
One thing that can't go unmentioned about McLuhan was that there's this kind of paradox of McLuhan as this quite reactionary, backward-looking guy, but yet who is able to think about things that are going to happen in the media sphere, you know, 40 years, you know, after he's dead. So what I'm trying to get at is the paradox of someone who is rooted in a spiritual tradition and quite profoundly reactionary in his sort of political formation, although he tended not to say that in public. But everything else was absolutely up for grabs in terms of thinking. So
right.
how does one approach the paradox of that?
Well, the thing that troubles me most about McLuhan is the sense that he doesn't, and perhaps correctly, that he doesn't trust people to run civilization. The whole notion, you know nothing of my work. That whole notion is, I think where he's coming from is, you know, 90% of people are just not capable of grasping what it is I'm saying, you know, and in that sense, I feel like he comes more from the tradition of Walter Lippmann than John Dewey, you know, that he understands that people are going to be manipulated by this stuff, that most of humanity are more like the iron filings moving between the magnets of corporate culture or governments, and had best be managed rather than overly inspired. For the most part, that he saw people as incapable of rising to the occasion of thought, but he was enough of a trickster and interested enough in human potentials that he advocated the sort of trickster experiments just to see what might happen.
And the thing I want to end with is, what bothers you most about the media sphere of the early 21st century and that you think really needs to be addressed and thought about?
What bothers me most about 21st century media sphere right now is that almost nobody knows how to program, you know, especially in the West, that kids who I thought raised in the digital sphere, who I believed would speak the digital language as natives, and instead they seem oblivious to the fact that there's even a language or a series of choices being made beneath the interfaces and software that they're using. And they've come to accept things like Google and Facebook as pre-existing conditions of the universe, as features of nature, rather than as creations of people, much less creations of corporations. And this willingness to accept the net and these tools at face value without exploring who are the real customers, who is the product, what does this thing do? On a basic level, not even on a McLuhan level, what is this tool for? Who is paying for this tool? What does it mean that I'm using it? Is so shockingly disempowering and so shockingly antithetical to the kind of the cyberpunk empowerment ethos that folks like us espoused. I mean, this is not the hacker ethic at play. This is the hypno ethic at play. And for a medium that its original promise was to break the captive hypnotic spell of television and restore a read-write sensibility to reality, for a medium that powerful to now be used the very opposite way, for it to be used rather than to open people's eyes to all of the closed systems in their reality, instead for it to help perpetuate the closedness of the economy and religion and marketing and entertainment and everything else, is nothing short of tragic.
Doug Rushkoff is a writer, speaker, filmmaker, graphic novelist, and broadcaster.
Once more, please.
The trouble is I keep thinking of improvements on these passages all the time, with emphasis upon lineality, continuity, and connectedness. In other words, visuality.
Where is A? It precedes B, and B follows A and precedes C.
Part of the reason McLuhan's way of thinking worked is that it came from outside the bubble of consensus thought. It's not often realized that it came essentially from the right. He was, like his heroes Pound and Lewis, a reactionary modernist. Unlike most on the right, Lewis, Pound and McLuhan were not nostalgic. In McLuhan's case, it was perhaps because he had God. He would walk every day from his office at the university to the cathedral to attend Mass, for the original kind of mass media, the kind that communicates with the eternal. But part of the limit to McLuhan's thought also comes from its reactionary modernist origins. Unlike Doug Rushkoff, he didn't ask questions about media in terms of power and domination. Unlike Paul Miller, he always thought of non-Western media environments as exotic. In these respects, he is a figure trapped in his time. While I may well have been influenced by McLuhan as a teenager to think and write about media, while I might even have turned into one of those future historians Robert Moore, the host of Monday Conference, talked about, I've gone looking in other places. In my book, The Beach Beneath the Street, I turned instead to those whose outsider perspective on the global village came from the left rather than the right. I'm talking about the Situationist International, who called the emerging media environment not the global village, but the society of the spectacle. But in writing The Beach Beneath the Street about this critique from the left of our society of the spectacle, I was often struck by how it chimed with McLuhan's take from the right. Perhaps both were performing that role that only those from outside the consensus mind can perform, of making us see the world otherwise, of making us think about this environment we move through like fish through water.
The trouble is I keep thinking of improvements on these passages all the time. Our time is a time for crossing barriers, for erasing old categories, for probing around. When two seemingly disparate elements are imaginatively posed, put in apposition in new and unique ways, startling discoveries often result. The medium of our time, electric circuit.
And that's it today for Big Ideas. The program sound engineer was Jenny Parsonage, producer Ian Coombe, and the McLuhan Project's executive producer, Cassie McCullough.
Once more, please.
For more on Marshall McLuhan, visit the ABC website, abc.net.au/rn/McLuhan. I'm Mackenzie Walk. Thank you for joining me. Bye for now.